Our first reflection is entitled A Parable on Privilege by Deroe K. Farrar. Mr. Farrar is the director of music for the First Unitarian Church of Portland, Oregon. When I was in middle school, I was taught every person to some extent holds a set of prejudices that impact our perceptions of others. We were asked to think about what our prejudices might be and how they might inform our relationships and our movements throughout the world. I knew immediately what my bias was. It was against wealthy people. I say was, but really, it's a prejudice I cling to even today. As a private school teacher who became an arts administrator, who became an opera singer, who became a music director for choir and theater, and who has found his way into Unitarian Universalist context, I recognize that wealthy people had funded my entire adult existence. My career has taught me to curb my lack of enthusiasm for the rich in support of the goal of professional success. My prejudice against the wealthy stems in part from the fact that I've never been wealthy myself. Every person in my family has had to work extremely hard to earn and save every dollar they've ever had. And I am certain that if I ever became wealthy, my feelings would likely shift. I am a church musician for a living, however, so wealth is not a prospect I can expect to ever experience. Beyond those reasons for this prejudice of mine, I'm also troubled by some of the ethics around wealth. There's a story in the Christian Bible that I've been thinking about a lot lately. It's recorded in the 19th chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew. It goes kind of like this. A young rich man approaches Jesus and asks what he can do to bring about the beloved community. Jesus replies by pretty much telling the man to go and do all the right things, treat people well, and spread love. The young man says that he's already doing those things, to which Jesus responds, "Then go and sell all your stuff and give your money to those who have less." As the story goes, the rich man went away in deep despair. It does not tell us what he decided to do, but I'm willing to bet he held on to his wealth. This is the story that leads us to the famous passage that warns it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for the wealthy to participate in activating the beloved community. In the innermost part of my being, I believe that it is unethical to be wealthy in a society where there is also poverty. My sensible self, however, recognizes their lack of justice in that conclusion too. There is nothing inherently wrong with being rich. And an argument can probably be made that there is nothing inherently wrong with not sharing one's wealth. Unless, of course, you're a Christian, in which case your faith demands it of you. No, there's nothing wrong with having a lot of money. The trouble comes in how we manage it. How do we manage the power it gives us? The trouble comes in how we use that wealth and power through both action and inaction to stifle the lives of those who have none. By now, I'm sure you're thinking that I've forgotten I'm offering these reflections in a service dedicated to examining institutional white supremacy. So give this a try. For decades, we have been preaching the message of how inequality and injustice are pervasive in Unitarian Universalist systems and institutions. Every time, there's a resurgence of energy from the well-meaning white liberals who comprise the bulk of this faith. They say, "We get it now. We finally see it. What can we do to help?" More often than not, those of us doing the preaching, those of us willing to be caught in the middle of this hopeless mess, steadfastly clinging to hope, respond with instructions, which books and articles to read, which classes, workshops, and rallies to attend, encouragement to recognize and own one's own privilege. we offer reminders that the beginning of dismantling this unfair system of white supremacy is in learning to recognize the points of privilege in one's own life. All of that is true, but it is also weak. So, well-meaning white liberals come back and say, great, we've been doing that and we've learned a whole lot, but we still feel like unintentional racists. What can we do? This is where we, those who bear the burden of teaching, too often respond with something like, well done, good and faithful justice advocate. Go and tell everyone you know what you've learned. So our well-intentioned siblings in faith do that and feel good about it. And yet racism persists. And a decade later, those same people are confused about what they missed the last time. Here's what we should be saying. Denounce all your privilege and give it to those with none. Denounce all your privilege and give it to those with none. Talk about an action item. I guarantee that would get folks' attention. Sadly, it will also likely mean they will go away, deep in despair, doing nothing at all. I believe, however, that we do not talk explicitly enough about the fact that every person's privilege is tied to our corrupted system of capitalism. This is true in our country, and it's also true in our Unitarian Universalist congregations. For a person to denounce their privilege, they would have to be willing to give up all they have mythically come to believe they have earned. If we're serious about dismantling the idea that white people are better than others, it means that white people have to stop accepting better salaries and benefits packages than their colleagues of color. It means preaching about living within our means instead of below them, to stop spending less money than we can afford to because our money has an impact on others. It means preaching against unethical gentrification. It means white people finally believing that they should not have everything they want just because they're able to access it through use of their inherited social capital. Look, as a black man, white people often frustrate me, but there's nothing inherently wrong with being white. And if you ask me, there's nothing inherently wrong with lacking racial diversity. That is, unless you're a Unitarian Universalist and your faith demands it of you. The problem is around the ethics of whiteness, how white people manage the power they have claimed. The trouble comes in how that privilege and power are used to stifle the lives of those who have none. This moment in our tradition calls for both introspection and a charge for bold commitment. We have practiced hope. We have practiced making promises. Now, we must promise action. Our next reflection is Black Joy by the Reverend Kimberly Quinn Johnson. And she begins with a poem called Joy Unspeakable by Barbara A. Holmes. Joy unspeakable is not silent. It moans, hums, and bends to the rhythm of a dancing universe. For our free African ancestors, joy unspeakable is drum talk. For enslaved Africans during the Middle Passage, joy unspeakable is the surprise of living one more day. For Africans in bondage in the Americas, joy unspeakable is the moment of mystical encounter when God tiptoes into the hush arbor. Joy unspeakable is humming how I got over after swimming safely to the other side of a swollen Ohio River when you know that you can't swim. When theologian Barbara A. Holmes talks about joy unspeakable, she's talking specifically about how the contemplative practices of the Black church have sustained Black people in America through suffering and survival. More than referring to a particular church or denomination, this experience is collective and trans-historical. It's also a different expression of Black religion than I'm expected to exhibit as a Black woman. On more than one occasion, I've had a particular mode of Black worship projected onto me, the more charismatic modes of Black worship that we're so familiar with, the shout, the stomp, the song. That particular style of Black worship sometimes strikes me as a caricature of joy, a shallow stereotype. I see this in the expectation that more Black worship will bring more lively singing, more rhythmic clapping, more energetic worship. I see this in the anxiety that more Black worship will bring more lively singing, more rhythmic clapping, and more energetic worship. The shout, the stomp, the song. But this caricature, this stereotype, is a narrow sliver of the complexity and richness of Black spirituality and Black worship. The modes of Black spirituality that are most powerful, nourishing, and nurturing for me aren't the stomp, shout, or song. Instead, I think of the rock, the sway, the bend, the moan, the hum. And I think of these things done in community. I marvel that in the midst of sadness and sorrow, in the midst of feeling the effects of generations of trauma wrought by racism and white supremacy, we can still find joy in each other. We are finding joy in each other. I call it Black joy because I am Black, and it is a joy that I have been familiar with my whole life. It is the joy that I have learned from Black people. It is the joy created through our collective healing, our laying down of burdens to be picked up and shared by our people, our community. This is not joy in spite of suffering, a mask put on to hide the pain, an armor put on to push through pain. This is an embrace, holding and soothing us in our suffering. This Black joy is joy created through our being together. This Black joy reminds me that I am not alone, that trouble don't last always, and that I am held and carried forward by a power beyond what I can comprehend. I call it Black joy, but I want to offer it to the extent that it is mine to offer to this faith. One of my gifts to Unitarian Universalism is a suggestion that joy is ours. We are the people who commit to justice, equity, and compassion. We are the people who aspire to world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. We are the people who affirm our interdependence with each other and with the universe itself. I want to challenge Unitarian Universalism and Unitarian Universalists to claim joy. Unitarian Universalist joy will require a different way of imagining ourselves and a different way of being with each other. Claiming the possibility of Unitarian Universalist joy requires making space for the surprises that Holm describes. Claiming the possibility of Unitarian Universalist joy requires slowing down to hear the talk of the drum, pausing to move to the rhythms of the drum. Unitarian Universalist joy requires opening to the possibility of a mystical encounter. Unitarian Universalist joy requires embodying this faith differently than many of us are accustomed to. Please rise and embody your spirit for hymn number 153, Oh, I Woke Up This Morning. Our next reflection is called Tired of Being Silent by Rayla D. Mattson. The summer of 2016 began as an exciting one for me. I was finally going to a beloved Unitarian Universalist conference and retreat center. I'd heard many wonderful stories about it, and I couldn't wait to bring my three children with me. On the drive there, I felt excited about spending a full week in an entirely UU space. After all, it was my UU community that so lovingly embraced me after a very painful divorce and several painful years of church shopping. I needed this week. I needed this healing. As UUs descended on the camp and found their rooms, I began to introduce myself to others and thought I noticed them offering me a cursory hello before making a quick getaway. Maybe, I thought, it was hard for people to speak to me because I had my one-year-old in tow. Maybe they were eager to reconnect to old friends. There was another Black woman at the camp who I had noticed. I was thankful we both signed up for the same program. I asked her, was it just me, or did she too feel a distinct coldness from the others? I wanted to make sure I wasn't just being paranoid. But unsettling things continued to happen. There was an issue with my daughter in childcare. They felt that she was a problem, and difficult in comparison with the other children. Although a very kind person noted that she couldn't understand how my child was deemed a problem when she was doing the same thing all the other children were doing. Then a black child, the same age as my son, 12 years old, came crying to me one night. He was being bullied, but he wasn't being heard because the adults around him insisted that they knew that girl and she would never say things like that. The child trusted me as a black mother. I was the only person at camp who would listen and believe in him. I brought the matter to the open, and the typical excuses followed, like the boy misunderstood what she meant, and he was just being too sensitive, and it was just in fun, and nothing was really meant by her comments. I tuned those excuses out, and I spent a lot of time alone that week. When my daughter and I walked around the conference center, I saw reminders of racism everywhere, from the statues and memorials to the paintings on the walls. It was everywhere. It was clear as day. Your kind are not welcome here. I would end my strolls by going to the dining hall, only to find there was no table for me. Not because there weren't empty chairs, because I was told there was no room at the table for me and my toddler. The empty seats were for other people, I was told, and they couldn't make room for me. The pattern became so distressing that on most days I considered not eating, but I couldn't let my child starve. If my new friend was there, she always made room for me. And there were the kids. After the incident with the young black boy, the kids came to me quite a bit to mediate things going on between them. They even took turns giving me a break for my little one. Eventually, one of them would see me trying to find a table, and no matter how many people were at their table, they would find a way to squeeze me in, me and my little one. As kind as they were, they ate quickly and were off. And again, I was left alone in the silence. As all the tables around me buzzed with talk and laughter, and I sat there alone, staring at my one-year-old. Then one evening, my youngest finally settled down enough for me to attend evening worship. I was so excited. I grabbed my lantern and journeyed to the chapel. The guest speaker spoke so eloquently, talking about what he called the elephant in the space, how the camp was rooted in racism. His words brought me to the edge of my seat. I was thrilled and excited. I hadn't been paranoid. The white man saw what I saw. He was naming my hurt, my truth, and I was elated. As we left the worship, my heart felt light. In the darkness that surrounded us, the voices started. I heard campers who couldn't see me, a black woman listening, agree that it was one of the worst services they had been at the camp, and how they couldn't believe he dared to say those things, and how they knew this place was for uplift, and he had brought them down. They did not want that kind of mess thrown in their face. I melted into the darkness that surrounded us, and that night, I cried myself to sleep. When I left the camp at the end of the week, the knot that had formed in my stomach started to ease. Once home, I shared my story, my truth, with multiple people who were connected to the camp and its programs, people who I believed might use my experience to make future conferences and retreats more welcoming. I even offered to teach to add some diversity to future retreats. I was told by each person they would pass on my information and that someone would contact me so they could get a better idea of what had happened and how I felt about it. And that never happened. I sent several emails and responded to all the surveys, and I asked to be heard. But as usual, when I bring up concerns about race, there's only silence in response. Fast forward nearly a year in the approach of another summer. My oldest two children chatted excitedly about going back to the camp, although I had explained it took 2 years of funds and this planning to go. They were still hopeful that we could make it for this summer. I felt anxious. I felt guilty. And I could feel the knot creeping back into my stomach. I wanted them to see their friends and go back to a place that they had come to love. And yet, I could not see myself stepping foot on that retreat center. I broke down one day. I shared with my oldest two children the experience that I'd had the previous summer. Their father is white, and at times I choose not to tell them things that I feel would cast a negative light on white people, as to not give them negative feelings towards their family or be torn about their own genetic makeup. But I could be silent no more. And as I shared with them my experiences and my time at the camp, they sat there, not saying a word, but staring at me with silent tears rolling down their cheeks. They asked me why I didn't say anything during our week at the camp. Why hadn't I shared with them sooner? Like a lot of parents, I answered that I wanted to protect them and not give a negative light to such an enriching experience that they had had. My oldest child then asked me if I often sit in silence and hold in the pain, and I answered him truthfully. I answered him with a yes. Many times as a black woman, I hold in my pain and my experiences to protect others, to keep and hold up white fragility that I have been taught, or rather trained, to value more than my own feelings, my own experiences, more even than my own needs and self-worth. I have been trained to minimize myself, my light, my voice, to just grin and bear it, to put up with it because I should know that they mean well, or I didn't want to seem to be too sensitive, or to be the angry black person in the room. But I'm tired of being silent. It's a heavy load to carry day in and day out. Sometimes I'd like to take off my blackness and pick it up another day. Sometimes it's just too heavy a load. But I can't, so I press on. So I ask this question, whenever someone will listen. Who is standing in your dining hall looking for a seat at the table? And can you make room for them too? And now for our closing prayer, I ask you to settle in for a moment of prayer. Let us open our hearts and still our minds. Let us call forth and hold in our hearts the stories of all who have come before us today. The memories of those who are with us and the hope for tomorrow for all those who come after us. Let us be thankful for this opportunity for healing, forgiveness, and reconciliation, while knowing that we can never, should never, forget what has brought us here today. Let us be glad that the voices of silence have now been heard, sharing their sorrow and pain. But the stories told by these voices have been received with the goal of redemption and understanding. Let us call upon that light which shines in each of us to give us the strength to walk together into the future and do the work that is necessary and which does not end here today. Let us have the wisdom to lovingly have the conversations we need to have with each other, that we must have with each other, in order to grow this faith in radical love and inclusion. Amen.